And our final case today, 2022-1312, Vandercar versus the Port Authority of Greater Cincinnati Development Authority. Good morning. On behalf of appellant, Beth Bryan, good morning.
Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, Beth Bryan for Vandercar LLC. With me today is my partner, Stuart Dornett. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please. This morning, I'm going to focus in on three fundamental errors committed by the lower court when it held that port authorities enjoy some immunity from liability, including immunity from prejudgment interest when they breach contracts. First, the lower court failed to interpret or apply the plain meaning of RC 4582.22A. In that statute, the General Assembly stated that port authorities perform essential government functions, but no port authority shall be entitled to immunity from liability by reason thereof. The lower court changed that statute to say that port authorities have some immunity from liability, and that's an error.
So in doing that, it relied on one of our recent cases, Icebreaker. Can you?
Bythus?
What's that?
The Bythus decision?
No, Icebreaker in saying essentially if it's not in the statute, it's not there. Because they kind of took Bythus and said, it wasn't specifically in the statute that prejudgment interest could be awarded. So looking at the Icebreaker case, it came from the Court of Appeals decision. And if you're able to distinguish that, because they're essentially citing our case to us and saying, the other side is, and saying that's why that's why there can be no award of prejudgment interest.
Well, let me step back and look at the history of what happened with the statute. When the Port Authority statute was passed in 1955, that's where we're going to start with our language. The original language, no liability thereof. What was happening at the time was the General Assembly had passed the statute and added in language saying Port Authority's consent to sue or be sued. That's in line with the language of a constitutional amendment in 1912 saying you can consent to be sued, states can consent to be sued in the court and in the manner that provide by law. But this court had interpreted a consent to sue or be sued as not being a full waiver of sovereign immunity for political subdivisions of the state. Instead, it had created this line of authority that said, if you engage in government functions, you're going to have immunity from liability. If you engage in proprietary functions, you're going to have no immunity from liability. And what was happening along the way was parties were litigating, is it a proprietary function or a government function? So the General Assembly, when it passed the Port Authority statute, took that off the table and said, they're engaging in government functions, but they're entitled to no immunity from liability by reason thereof, no immunity from performing government functions. The holding of the case is that they're entitled to government immunity, they're entitled to immunity from liability by performing government functions. At the time the statute was passed in 1955 and reauthorized in 1982, the Bythus decision didn't exist. Instead, the law for political subdivisions at that time comes from the 1935 decision in Gibson, which is subordinate political subdivisions of the state are subject to general statutes unless they're specifically exempted. There was no idea that subordinate political subdivisions were immune from interest unless the General Assembly expressly stated it. It was the opposite. So when the General Assembly passed 1343.03A, it intended to make political subdivisions of the state subject to prejudgment interest unless they specifically said they were not subject to that. And the statute doesn't say that. It does not exempt them. So looking at the law in the historical context, what did the General Assembly intend when they passed the Port Authority statute and when they passed the prejudgment interest statute? They plainly intended that all entities within the state were going to be subject to prejudgment interest. At the time, again, in 1982, when the Port Authority statute was passed, the law of the state was clear. The state had already waived the right to prejudgment interest in the Court of Claims Act, and the Court of Claims Act says the state is going to be subject to prejudgment interest in civil actions at the same rate and in line with private parties.
So what the point I'm making, though, is that the Court of Appeals said, therefore, we decline to read into the phrase, quote, no port authority is immune from liability by reason, and then parenthetically added, of its government functions, a statutory requirement to assess prejudgment interest against a port authority. Then they went to a 2022 case from this court, C. In re Icebreaker Wind Power, Inc., and they quote from that decision, we may not add words to a statute to achieve a desired construction. And they say, then conclude, that if the legislature intended to assess prejudgment interest against a port authority in a contract action, it could have done so. Do you see a problem with this language, based on what you just said?
I see a problem, because what the General Assembly said at the time was that their port authority shall have no immunity from liability. And what the lower court said was they have some immunity from liability. And that is what the other side has argued. My friend has always argued, we're not arguing that they're entitled to, we've never argued sovereign immunity. We're arguing that we have some immunity and this BIFAS immunity. And the issue in BIFAS has never been extended to the idea of a commercial contract setting. It has been the law in Ohio since 1854 in this court's decision in State versus Executor of Buttles, that the state enters into contracts at the same term and at the same rate as private parties. Here, the General Assembly decided in 1980 to expand contractual liability for all parties in the state and to say that all parties that breach contracts have to pay prejudgment interest. There's been no change. The idea that the Port Authority would be immune from prejudgment interest when the state of Ohio is not immune from prejudgment interest, when municipalities that also create port authorities are immune from prejudgment interest, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, counsel, your friends, I anticipate on the other side, are going to say, well, when the legislature changed the Court of Claims Act to allow for prejudgment interest, they didn't do it in the section that governs port authorities.
Right, because they didn't have to. I mean, the law that existed at the time, there was no law that existed at the time that told the General Assembly that you had to expressly consent for subordinate political subdivisions. Again, the law that existed under Gibson in 1935 was that general statutes applied to subordinate political subdivisions unless the General Assembly expressly exempted them. So by not exempting them, the intent was that they would be included in the statute. The Court of Claims Act is very different. The state is the ultimate sovereign, and the law that traces back always applies to the state. It doesn't necessarily trickle down to lower political subdivisions. The General Assembly has understood and created categories. They've created the state, and they have created entities that are not the state, and they've done that in the Political Subdivision Act. What they have said is, you're not entitled to the same rights as the state. And what the court has done has elevated their rights below, or elevated the port authority rights above the rights of the state, with no explanation tracking back into law of where this came from. In the BIFAS decision, they created this idea of an arm of the state. That doesn't exist in the statutes. It's just an idea that you're not the state for some purposes, but you are the state for other purposes. And the only purpose seems to be to create immunity in certain settings. And it doesn't make any sense in a breach of contract case. The other thing about the BIFAS decision that I think is unique and sometimes gets lost, that was not a breach of contract case. It was a mandamus action, a declaratory judgment action, and a claim for injunctive relief. 1343.03a does not have a section for prejudgment interest for those types of claims. And the language in BIFAS says 1343.03a does not apply to these types of claims. It clearly applies to breach of contract claims. There's no dispute in the law that everybody in Ohio who breaches a contract is subject to prejudgment interest automatically as a matter of law. So then the question is, what does immunity from liability mean? And does that encompass prejudgment interest requirements? The statute doesn't define liability, but what the dictionary definition is it's a very broad word, and it means legal responsibility. So is the port exempt from any legal responsibility? And the General Assembly has said no. The General Assembly has said, You're subject to all the rights and obligations as everybody else in the state. And within the Port Authority statute, there are other language, there's other language, immunity from civil liability is used in there. They didn't qualify it in the beginning. The General Assembly took the broadest stance that they could and said, you are going to be entitled to no immunity from liability. And the port has never addressed what that language means. They don't give an application of the plain meaning. Instead, they skip straight to the law, and then they make a policy argument about prejudgment interest and whether it should apply. But in this situation, it makes no sense. If the roles were reversed and Vandercar breached their contract, they would be paying prejudgment interest. And the law in Ohio is that the government enters into contracts on the same foot and subject to the same obligations as their private parties. There is no reason to create an exemption here, and there's not one found in the statutes. I do want to address the idea about the Court of Claims statute. And again, that Court of Claims statute provides guidance here about the scope of the waiver. The Court of Claims statute is a limited waiver. It provides exceptions. You cannot sue the state, as you guys heard earlier this morning, for all things. There are other immunities that still exist. The Port Authority statute is a broad waiver. It waives all sovereign immunity. It consented to sue and be sued. And this court has held in cases after Bifus that that language, consenting to sue or be sued, encompasses all claims and retains no immunity. But again, the statute went further because it recognized the idea that there were some judicially created immunities that weren't covered with the sue or be sued language. So they said, we're going to give a broad term that says you're performing government functions, but you're going to have no immunity from liability. So again, the only question is whether RC 1343.03a creates some immunity from liability, and it doesn't.
Mrs. Bryan, the statute waives immunity based upon the function that's involved.
Correct.
Byford isn't concerned with what function is involved. It's concerned with the status of the judgment debtor as an arm of the state. Isn't that an important distinction?
I mean, the distinction, there are several distinctions with Bifus. One being that the statute in Bifus, the school board statute, did not have the no immunity from liability language. The court didn't address that language. The port will, I think, concede that their exercise of entering into this contract was a government function. They were taking their role in a government function, but now they're claiming some immunity based on the fact that they were engaged in a government function. I mean, the Bifus decision, again, different.
Really, that's not my question. A port authority can only perform, every function they perform is a governmental function.
Correct.
By statute.
Correct.
But my question is that important to our analysis if we're going to follow Byford, because Byford is based upon the status of the judgment debtor, not whether it's a governmental or proprietary function?
I mean, I think that the Bifus decision, the majority decision, I think is difficult to parse. It doesn't relate to the language in the statute. It doesn't give much guidance into what was happening, except for the idea that we're not going to extend the Carbone decision to this claim here. The idea of the port having some immunity, I mean, I think the question you're saying is, well, does it matter who the debtor is? I don't think that it does. The question is whether the port is entitled to some immunity, some relic of sovereign immunity. And if so, where does that come from? Or did the General Assembly intend to waive all immunity for the port? And the statute says we're waiving all immunity for the port.
Good morning, Mr. Buells.
Good morning.
Can you talk about the difference between damages and that are related to the claim and the award of prejudgment interest in terms of proprietary function, in terms of immunity? I'm looking specifically at 4582.22A, because you have Bifus that's making it clear that there's a waiver of prejudgment interest immunity unless there's a clear indication in the statute that waiver is intended. And if we've got a historical view that interest is an element of damages separate from damages on the substantive claim, how does that affect your argument?
May it please the court and Justice Bruner. So in 4582.22a, it says nothing at all about interest. What it says is the port can sue and be sued. That's the first clause. And the second clause says that it performs essential government functions, but is not immune from liability by reason thereof. That is not a waiver of total sovereign immunity, as appellant argues. In fact, this court in Bifus recognized a statute that does contain such language, and that's the Court of Claims Act, which we've been discussing today. The Court of Claims Act does several things that 4582.22a does not. It does contain language about the state consenting to sue and be sued, but it specifically says the state waives sovereign immunity. So first, waiver is not in the port statute. Second, what it does is it says when the state sues and is sued in the Court of Claims, it is subject to the same rules as private litigants. That also is not found in the port statute. Most importantly, there is an entire separate section of under Bifus, clearly expressed legislation authorizing prejudgment interest to be assessed against the state in the Court of Claims. That's a separate statute. That's 2743.18a. As with respect to remedy versus claims, so sue and be sued is generally a governmental entity can sue and be sued. It can be made liable in court. But the courts have held that that does not define what claims or remedies they might be sued for. That has to be done through clearly expressed legislation, and that is Bifus. This court should not overrule Bifus. This court should instead affirm the decision below, holding that appellant is not entitled to prejudgment interest for at least three reasons. First, the First District correctly held that the Bifus case controls this issue, and because the port is an arm of the state and this is a contract action, that is all that matters, and prejudgment interest cannot be assessed. Second, the First District correctly held that Revised Code 13.43.03a, the general prejudgment interest statute, does not constitute clearly expressed legislative intent to authorize prejudgment interest against an arm of the state. That's what the Bifus court held. This court, the lower court, was following Bifus.
And as a corollary to that, you're saying if the General Assembly had intended that, it surely showed it knowed how to do so.
Absolutely. In the Court of Claims. This court looked to the Court of Claims in the Bifus case and rejected another argument that appellant raises, which is because the state is subject to prejudgment interest in the Court of Claims because the General Assembly decided it that way, that therefore it's available in all contract actions against an arm of the state. The Bifus court rejected that exact argument, and that's what they're raising here. So the Bifus court rejected both of those arguments. And I should note that appellant waived all arguments relating to 4582.22a by not raising them in the trial court. They moved solely under 13.43.03a. The port then, in its opposition, raised Bifus, raised Bifus's rejection and in the no-interest rule, and then in response, they still filed two more briefs and never said a word about 4582.22a, never said a word about that statute waiving total sovereign immunity. So this court is well within its discretion to dismiss this appeal under both propositions of law as improvidently accepted after a thorough review. However, if the court rules on the merits, this court should follow the First District's decision and affirm, because in addition, the lower court correctly held, as this court has asked questions about, 4582.22a does not constitute clearly expressed legislative intent to authorize prejudgment interest against an arm of the state. Under Bifus,
I mean, isn't Bifus at least a lot of its rationale undermined by Ziegler?
It is not, Your Honor. Thank you. And the reason it's not is because Ziegler itself said our decision is consistent with Bifus. Ziegler is a tort case. Prejudgment interest is allowed against an arm of the state in tort cases. Ziegler went on to say Bifus is clearly distinguishable. That was a contract case. And it reiterated the broad rule under Bifus, which is it is an extreme measure.
Well, why does that matter?
It matters because the court in Bifus said it is an extreme measure to expand contractual liability against an arm of the state. It should only be done through clearly expressed legislation by...
Okay, but why is that different than tort? I get what they said, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
It's different because it's predictable. In contract actions, for over 100 years, going all the way back to Parrott, every arm of the state has known that there's no general assembly, no revised code section authorizing prejudgment interest against them. And if they did not negotiate it for it at the bargaining table, BIFAS says if neither of those are met, no prejudgment interest should lie. So they've relied on that precedent here. And if the court were to overrule BIFAS, which, by the way, is absolutely a contract action, the BIFAS case says.
So do you think they could have contracted?
Absolutely, they could have. That's what BIFAS says. BIFAS says at the bargaining table or clearly expressed legislation. To distill those issues here, they are asking this court to overrule BIFAS. They are asking the court to give what the General Assembly specifically decided.
If it's an aspect of sovereign immunity, could one port authority really waive that?
No. It's up to the general legislation.
Right. Well, that's what I'm asking about the contract issue then. If it's really because of sovereign immunity that they're not liable for interest, could an individual port authority really waive that?
Under BIFAS, yes. BIFAS says either through clearly expressed legislation, that's General Assembly, or at the bargaining table negotiating it into a contract. So to distill it, they are asking this court to force the port to pay prejudgment interest when the General Assembly said you're not entitled to it, and they failed to negotiate for it at the bargaining table, and then they failed at the trial court to raise this specific argument.
The other side's going to pay prejudgment interest, as they point out. Why shouldn't the port have to?
That's the law. The General Assembly decides who should pay prejudgment interest and not. It goes all the way back to the Parrott case. The Parrott case says that unless there's a contractual promise to pay it or there is clear legislative intent authorizing it, prejudgment interest, in that case interest, shall not be assessed against the state. So again, they're asking this court to overrule BIFAS, which this court should not do under stare decisis or any other principle. They're also asking for an exception that wouldn't even apply in this case. My colleague conceded that the port was entering into this contract in a governmental function. Its powers are dictated by the General Assembly. It argues for this commercial activity exception under the Loeffler v. Frank case, which is a federal case. That is not a commercial activity exception. That was a commercial entity, a for-profit entity that was authorized by Congress to make money, the U.S. Postal Service. They're arguing for a commercial activity exception that case didn't even recognize. It would be a completely unworkable exception here because every private entity would claim a private contract. But the port cannot use public funds for a private purpose. That's the McElroy case in 1959.
So the Millennium Hotel, located across the street from the Convention Center, would make it more proprietary than if it was a hotel located on the outskirts of town, just randomly competing with other hotels, correct?
Respectfully, I disagree, Your Honor. This is not about a proprietary function.
I'm saying that it's more of a government function by being there to support the Convention Center, which is commerce and so forth for the area, than it would be just a random hotel someplace else in town that competes with other hotels? Or is that not able, are we not even able to read that into it?
That, I think, would fall under their proposed exception, which there's no basis for that whatsoever. But to answer your question, the port can only act pursuant to its governmental powers given to it under the revised code. 4582.31a has 27 separate subparts. Both aspects of how appellant got paid in this case are public functions that are authorized by the General Assembly. 4582.31a4 authorizes the port to acquire property. That's all this contract was an assignment to acquire property. And the first payment trigger was once the property was acquired, a payment was owed. That's a specific government function. Secondly, the second payment trigger was for when there was issuance of revenue bonds. That's 4582.31A7. Again, specifically a government function. A private entity cannot issue no non-tax revenue bonds. There is absolutely no exception to the BIFAS rule. This court and every court below it has uniformly, absolutely, every time an arm of the state has come up in a contract action and the other side has asked for prejudgment interest, this court and the lower courts have denied it, and they should do so here. There's no basis whatsoever for an exception to BIFAS. They've not identified any. They've confused the issues by trying to argue that the port wants to be a government actor in one sense and a private actor in another. This is a public contract. The port could not have entered into a private purpose contract where they are aiding a private company. Again, the McElroy case says 4582.22 does not allow the port to do that.
Thank you.
BIFAS is not limited, likewise, to wage disputes. It's not limited to school boards. BIFAS has been applied, again, uniformly. It's been applied to sheriff's departments. It's been applied to Department of Human Services, and this court should apply it here as well, because the port is indisputably an arm of the state. So even if this court were to adopt the exception, which has no basis for a commercial entity, the port wouldn't fit under that. The port wouldn't fit under the proposed exception for commercial activity either.
Well, but do any of those other situations, is there language like there is in the Port Authority Act that says it's not subject to liability thereof as a result of doing a government function?
So I think
all the things you rattled off, they don't have that language in their statute, right?
That specific language, correct. I think the closest corollary would be the Court of Claims, which specifically waives sovereign immunity, which this statute does not. There is no language saying the port waives sovereign immunity. There's nothing saying they waive all. They've inserted the word all and the word sovereign into the issue that this court accepted.
But isn't that different because this is a subdivision of the state, not the state? I mean, historically, subdivisions haven't been entitled to sovereign immunity.
There are two issues there. First, the General Assembly decided to make the state subject to prejudgment interest in the Court of Claims, which also includes state agencies. They specifically, in the statute itself.
But again, isn't that different because with the Court of Claims Act, sovereign immunity exists, and then there's a waiver of sovereign immunity, whereas with political subdivisions, there's no sovereign immunity because it's created by the state.
So sovereign immunity and interest immunity are related, but they are distinct issues. The no interest rule goes all the way back to the Parr case. That is a common law rule. So specifically, in the Court of Claims, the state is subject to prejudgment interest. Relatedly, they've raised municipalities and said, well, the court below or the port is asking for more protection than municipalities get or the state gets. First, the General Assembly decided the state was not entitled to immunity from interest. Second, this court in BIFAS specifically addressed that exact argument about municipalities and rejected it out of hand. And the reason is because municipal corporations enjoy broad, expansive powers. They have their own charters. They get to set their own rules. They have significant home power rules. And this court said in BIFAS, that's why they're different than school boards. School boards and the ports have their powers and duties conferred upon them by the revised code. They are detailed extensively. The port is a nonprofit governmental actor, and it has to act for authorized purposes. That's what it did in this case. So whether we're talking about BIFAS, which is the law, and under stare decisis, there is no basis to overrule this. It was correctly decided at the time. It's been applied uniformly by this court and the lower courts to every single arm of state that has been subject to a claim for prejudgment interest in a contract action. Secondly, it does not defy practical workability. There's no murkiness, as my colleague suggested. Contract action, arm of state, prejudgment interest. That's a very easy rule to apply, and that's what the lower court did correctly. And third, as amici have raised, it would create an undue hardship for arms of state who relied on this rule going all the way back to the Parrott case in 1881 to all of a sudden be subject to prejudgment interest when this court in every decision has said arms of the state are not in contract actions subject to that. It would also waive over a century of precedent holding that political subdivisions are not subject to quasi-contract or implied contract liability.
Why would it be a hardship on port authorities to know that they would be liable if they breached a contract for?
Sure. Because when they enter into these contracts, the BIFAS rule says the General Assembly has to decide whether or not they're subject to prejudgment interest, and they have relied on that for over a century. And they're
You think there's a reliance interest in not having to pay interest if you breach something?
Excuse me?
That doesn't seem like the kind of reliance interest that we would typically protect.
What type of interest?
Reliance interest.
Reliance interest. I think to answer your question, they also know that when they enter into that contract, if the other side does not attempt to or successfully negotiate into the contract, that's what BIFAS says, the right to prejudgment interest, then it cannot lie. So it's very predictable. General Assembly, they failed to negotiate it. That's the rule of law. The court should affirm the decision below.
Excuse me, you were kind of arguing home rule a minute ago in a backhanded sort of way, except it wouldn't really apply to port authorities since they're just separately created statutory entities, correct?
To be clear, the BIFAS court was making a distinction about why arms of the state are different than municipalities who have home rule. Municipalities set their own rules, whereas the arms of the state are subject to what the General Assembly says they can and cannot do. They're also limited by what the General Assembly says they can and cannot do. The port doesn't have home rule authority. That's why the BIFAS case says they're different.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, I want to address your question about Icebreaker and the status there. That was a wage dispute. And every case that has applied BIFAS since its decision has been a wage dispute. And those wage disputes exist as a matter of statute with public employees. They are not contract actions. There is no claim for contract in BIFAS. It's a mandamus, declaratory judgment, and injunctive relief case. BIFAS also is a narrow holding. The syllabus of BIFAS, which at the time was the only holding in the case, says a public school board of education is not liable for payment of prejudgment interest on award of back pay absent a statute requiring such payment. That's it. It applied to school boards and employee wage disputes by the holding of this court. It has never been extended beyond a wage dispute. The question, Justice DeWine, that you ask about the other statutes and whether they applied, there's only five other statutes in the state of Ohio that has the same no immunity from liability language. Those entities all are economic driving entities that issue bonds for various public purposes. These are unique entities, and they're not arms of the state. They don't exist separately under the statute. They are created solely by municipalities. They cannot exist on their own. A municipality has to authorize a port to be created. So then to say they're arms of the state, what they're advocating is a rule that essentially swallows up what the General Assembly has decided. We have the state, and we have lesser political subdivisions of the state. What they are advocating is that the lesser political subdivisions become the state and are granted more protections than the state has granted itself. And there's no explanation for that. There's no reason for that. And it's not consistent with the law, especially on breach of contract claims. Again, the law in Ohio for more than 100 years is private parties and states, when they enter into contracts, they enter it onto the same terms and subject to the same rule. The General Assembly, when it passed the Port Authority Act, knew and understood that, and what they said was they're entitled to no immunity from liability. That includes all damages, all liabilities in the state, the prejudgment interest requirements, that liability. Prejudgment interest, as this court has held, is a component of damages. It is designed to make the non-breaching party whole for the period of time when they do not have the money. It's no different than post-judgment interest, and this court held that in Royal Electric Construction versus Ohio State. There is no reason to carve out this one category component of damages and say that it doesn't apply, especially if the only argument is that you're prejudiced by it.
But is prejudgment interest actually a substantive component of damages?
The court has said that it is. It's designed to make a non-breaching party whole. This case took 21 months to go from the time the breach was filed or the breach occurred until the time the judgment happened. The $5 million that should have been paid in February of 2020 is not $5 million when it will eventually be paid because of the difference in time value of money. Prejudgment interest, the General Assembly granted it in breach of contract cases to make up that difference, to make the non-breaching party whole. It is absolutely a component of damages, and it makes no sense to carve it out.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You will receive a decision from the court. Marshall, please close the court.